Hello, everyone, to the podcast introduction to this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour. I'm Clay Jenkins, and with a slight head cold, you perhaps can hear it, and across from me here in the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn.
Keeping my distance.
Yes, separated by three cows and a hog.
Yes.
Is Mr. David Swenson.
I'm sorry you're suffering, but I don't
know. You know, it just happened last night, and I don't understand why, but this is such a great time for me. It's the new year.
Yep.
We're back to Jefferson 101.
Oh, geez, and it's so much fun.
It is so much fun. We had a really, you know, I have to say this, and it's going to sound heretical. I like being out of character talking about Jefferson more than I even like being in character being Jefferson.
Well, that makes me feel like I'm not doing a good job talking to the president.
No, you know, it's not at all. It's just
more
that—
More gardening.
I get to say things out of character of a more analytical sort. When I'm in character, I have to be Jefferson. I have to try to espouse his way of looking at the world. When I think what a humanities scholar brings to it is an understanding of that view of the world, but also an understanding of the larger context of the world and how it's played out over history. And so I really very much enjoy Jefferson 101. We've neglected it. We started it a year ago. We got him through the French Revolution. Now, finally, as 2017 begins, we have him back home. What we didn't mention in this show was that when he got home on the 23rd of November, 1789, in the Hampton Roads, the ship burned.
Oh, I didn't.
The ship that brought him home started on fire.
I've forgotten that.
And he and his daughters, Martha and Maria, and slaves Sally and James Hemings, watched in agony as all their stuff, all their luggage was still on. And I don't just mean luggage. I mean the 86 crates of stuff that Jefferson had purchased in France. They're all on this boat, and the boat is burning. But luckily, they put the fires out, and Jefferson's five couches and 59 chairs, et cetera, were not damaged.
We talked about this early on. This is a chance to talk about Jefferson and Hamilton and sort of get to some of the bottom of that, and we did that. Can I do something that you do
may.
I never do?
You may.
Researching, reacquainting myself for this program, I came across two books that I think are really good.
Well, let's hear.
The first is The Art of Power by John Meacham.
Now, we used to be a little bit harder on that book.
Yeah, but going back to it, I enjoyed it. It's, you know, he has a real even hand in this.
He's a great writer.
And, you know, when you reference several books at a time over the same historical period, it's easy to see what pops on top. And that, to me, is one of them. The other one is Madison and Jefferson, by Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but in Ken Burns' documentary on Jefferson, Andy Burstein and I, along with Joseph Ellis, are the principal talking
right,
heads.
Right, yeah, it's been a while.
Andy was just a kid back then.
And Ellis doesn't even talk about this period of his life. I think it goes from one section to another.
Oh, you mean Ellis's book, American Sphinx
yeah.
Overlooks the – this is – well, you know, for every – the problem with the biography – is that if you're writing about Churchill or if you're writing about Theodore Roosevelt or writing about Hamilton or Jefferson, you have to cover all 83 years of Jefferson's life.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all equally interesting.
Oh, but this one is.
But most scholars want to get him into the presidency, and so they kind of overlook this very important episode. And I think you said it right in the program that Jefferson is learning how to be the president of the United States.
He never would have become – he would not have become president had it not been for the time he spent as Secretary of State.
Now you're sounding like Roosevelt in Fargo, but you're right.
What?
You know, Roosevelt in Fargo said, I would never have been the president of the United States had it not been for the time I spent in North
Dakota.
That's
where that rhythm came from.
But Jefferson, you're right.
Busted. And
Jefferson got mad. So he comes back. He doesn't think he's going to be long in the United States, a couple of months, and he's going to go back to France. He comes back. He finds out immediately that Washington has made him Secretary of State. He makes a bona fide effort to weasel out of it. Washington is firm. Madison says, you've got to do it. So Jefferson does it. And what he discovers is that he is a minority figure in what's amounts to a conservative counter-revolutionary moment in American life, and that Washington has next to him an incredibly talented and gifted and indefatigably ambitious young minister of finance by the name of Alexander Hamilton. And Jefferson had expected that he'd be the one, that Jefferson would be the figure, the great figure of the Washington administration after the president himself. And what he discovers is that his views are eccentric, way more radical than the rest of the cabinet, even more radical than Washington, and that Hamilton opposes him almost by instinct on every question, and Hamilton wins almost every debate. It drives Jefferson nuts to think that he could have been in France.
Let's go to the program and know, listeners, that this conversation does not end with this episode. We shall pick it up again next week.
We're immensely grateful for our listeners. Let's listen to Jefferson 101, the first of two on his time as the first Secretary of State. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, brought to you by Bismarck State College on the banks of the Missouri River at the heart of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. The Thomas Jefferson Hour was created by the gentleman who portrays President Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, and the gentleman seated across from me now, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, my very good friend, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. David Swenson.
And I can barely contain my excitement. We are back onto Jefferson 101. We sort of made a promise and didn't live up to it. Would you care to explain?
Well, 2016 proved to be a wild year in American history, a wild year in North Dakota history, one of the most colorful presidential elections in American history, certainly of my lifetime, culminating on November 8th in the election of Donald Trump of New York to that office. And here in our beloved North Dakota on the northern Great Plains, an event probably of much greater historical importance, the protest on and near the Standing Rock Indian Reservation over a proposed oil pipeline that would cross the Missouri River just north, that is upstream from the sovereign territory of the Standing Rock Sioux. So those things really distracted, amused, were problematic in 2016. And I felt almost every week, we've got to get back to our ongoing out-of-character biography of Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson 101. When we conceived this project about a year ago, we thought maybe we could do it in 10 shows. It probably will run to 30 before this is over. But I know that you and I are both dedicated in this, the new year of 2017, to getting back on track with our biographical analysis of Jefferson as we understand him in the second decade of the 21st century.
Agreed. And I have to admit that some of it is self-serving for me because I enjoy so much being able to listen to you, Professor Jenkinson, and pick your brain as you tell us the story of Jefferson. When we ended back in 2016, we had, I believe we had 3 weeks, delightful discussions about Jefferson's time in Paris. And at this point, Jefferson is on his way back to the Americas.
To go to the beginning, Jefferson was born in 1743 and he died in 1826. He was a young Virginian who grew up on a slave plantation with a largely self-made father and a much more socially prominent mother. His father died when he was 14. His mother died when he was 33. Jefferson was a brilliant young man, an odd young man, deeply devoted to learning in a way that was pretty surprising for frontier Virginia, privately schooled until he went up to the College of William and Mary at about the age of 17. And there his life really moves in a new direction. He meets his beloved mentor, William Small, who Jefferson said set the destinies of my life. Jefferson then becomes a figure in the Enlightenment, and he will be a figure exemplifying the principles and the goals of the Enlightenment for the rest of his long and extremely fruitful life. He struggles to figure out what to do about women in marriage, has a couple of false starts, eventually marries a woman that he adored, Martha Wales, who was a widow, has 6 children with her, 4 of whom die before their 7th birthday, 2 live to be adults. When Martha herself dies, his wife, on September 6, 1782, Jefferson is devastated. really broken by grief, and his plan of life was shattered. But he recovered, and his closest friend, James Madison, decided that it would be useful to get Jefferson out of the country, out of the scenes of his grief. So Jefferson goes off to France as the American minister to several European courts and eventually becomes the American minister to France, effectively the ambassador to replace the retiring Dr. Benjamin Franklin, and has five really remarkable years in France. Remarkable because, A, he recovered his own spirits. He sort of bounced back from his grief, so Madison had been right. B, he fell in love with European high culture, music, dance, salon conversation, painting, sculpture, symphonic music, opera, wine. And C, much more important than either of those, Jefferson had the chance to observe a true revolution. Our independence movement from Britain was important, pivotal in the history of the world, but it was a relatively benign transition from imperial rule to the sort of agrarian republic that came out of it. The French Revolution was a cataclysm, was a true revolution of the profoundest sense. And Jefferson was fortunate to be there at the beginnings of it and to observe it and in some small ways to advise the moderates of the revolution. And he had hoped that he would spend a few months back in the United States in Virginia, deposit his daughters back on his home plantation, return to France and watch the outcome, to see the revolution through, which he hoped that the French Revolution would end with what he called the establishment of a free and well-governed republic. It did not. He did not get to see the worst excesses of the revolution, including the Reign of Terror, but he watched them with fascination and growing trepidation from his new post as America's first Secretary of State.
So we have Jefferson greatly affected by what he has seen in France. There were those who called him Frenchified and believe he was a bit too much of, I guess I would say, a liberal and too much European thought. But he came back to America, landing on the 23rd of November, 1789, and it said he went directly to the Epps's estate.
He went to Eppington, which is the estate for the Epps's. Epps was a sister-in-law, and he had placed his daughter Maria Polly with the Epps when he went to France, and he had summoned her from their estate. But he went immediately there, partly so that Polly, Maria, could be reconnected with people who were as close to her as she was to her father.
She had
a
great deal of affection for them, I'm told.
Indeed. And so it actually took, I think, Jefferson and his daughters a month to get from Norfolk, where they landed on the 23rd of November, back to Monticello. This was very typical Virginia traveling at the time. You stop at great houses and you pay your respects and you meet all of your kin. And these people were heavily interconnected through marriages and so on.
But there was a rumor that was in the Virginia papers that I guess came true for Jefferson on December 11th.
When he got to Eppington for this reunion with his sister and the Epps family, a letter was waiting for him from George Washington, the new president of the United States. So he had read a newspaper on the shoreline that said he had been appointed and confirmed as the Secretary of State, but he couldn't necessarily believe that. But then when he got to Eppington, here was a letter from the president himself saying that this was the case, strongly urging Jefferson to accept. Jefferson did not want to accept this post for a number of reasons. Madison said, look, Madison was always Jefferson's wiser, more pragmatic, somewhat more pessimistic best friend. Madison said, of course you have to accept a post that's been offered to you by the first president of the United States, a fellow Virginian, the hero of the war, the greatest man in the world. You would be in a very difficult position to say no.
Well, there's a letter that you and I discussed the other day that he wrote to the president on the 15th, and He doesn't say, absolutely not, I'm not going to do this, but pretty close to that, doesn't he?
He says, please, you know, spare me. My plan is to go back to France. I only perceive difficulties and controversies if I take on this post. I'm not even sure what the post involves, but I know that if I were planning to return to the United States, it would not be with a plan to return into government.
You know, I'd like you to actually read part of that letter. Before we go there, though, I think it's worth taking a moment to take a look at President Washington, because he really is responsible for shaping so many of the aspects of the president, and we take them for granted today. I mean, it was Washington that actually created the president's cabinet, correct?
The cabinet is not a constitutional office.
Right. So there was, I mean, this was his idea.
He surrounded himself with a few advisors, and so he it's not unprecedented in human history, but the Constitution was silent on this question, and he chose to create a cabinet. It only included three members in the beginning, but it has since grown until we have a huge cabinet now, and it has a quasi-constitutional status in the 21st century, even though our written constitution is entirely silent about such questions. And so Washington did that. He also set the style that the president would be aloof, that he was not going to be a man of the people. He was going to detach himself from the masses in some ways, ceremonially, in the way he dressed, in the way he traveled, in how he greeted average Americans who had access to him, how he corresponded with people, how he mingled with them when he went on his two trips. Washington in one period went into the American South for a number of weeks, and then on another occasion went through the northeastern states. Washington had to set the protocols for all of this, and there's a famous incident in which he went up to Congress to consult with them about an Indian treaty, and the Congress kept him waiting and then sort of treated him as if he were subordinate to them, and he threw a fit, as he had a huge temper, and he said, never again, I'm never going back. And he never did, and so, except to give his State of the Union messages, but he set a precedent then that the president does not submit himself to congressional scrutiny.
I also think it's quite interesting who his first appointee was.
And that is, of course, Colonel Alexander Hamilton.
He wanted Gouverneur Morris, right?
Yes.
But he was turned down.
Gouverneur Morris was one of his closest friends. Gouverneur doesn't mean governor. Gouverneur was actually this man's first name. He was a high-toned, one-legged, peg-legged Federalist and a womanizer and a cynic and a really extraordinary man, really a marvelous character from this era. But Washington settled on Alexander Hamilton.
We're going to take just a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment to talk about Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, we're talking about President Thomas Jefferson. We've gotten back into the Jefferson 101 series, and we're talking about Jefferson becoming the first Secretary of State. In the last segment, we kind of gave some background and talked about how this all happened, but I alluded to a pair of letters. One that Jefferson wrote to President Washington trying to say no, and one that Washington wrote back saying, I don't accept that. Now, maybe that's a little bit too much in modern parlance, but essentially that's what it is, isn't it?
Well, you know, Jefferson is such an extraordinary human being. When you read this letter, you see the way his mind worked. So he's exquisitely polite, deferential, respectful, opinionated and firm in his own view of what's best for him and what's best for the country. But Jefferson, you know, one of his commandments, he wrote his own Decalogue late in life, and one of them was take things always by their smooth handle. And you can see it here. I mean, I just love the quality of character that you see here. So let me just read you a couple of sentences.
Oh, please. It needs to be heard out loud. Yes.
December 15th, 1789, from Chesterfield, so between Norfolk and Monticello. He says, I've received at this place the honor of your letters and so on. I am truly flattered by your nomination of me to the very dignified office of Secretary of State, for which permit me here to return you my humble thanks. Could any circumstances seduce me to overlook the disproportion between its duties and my talents? It would be the encouragement of your choice. So he starts by saying, you know, I'm not really qualified for so lofty and important an office, but if I could overcome that, I would be flattered that you have thought of me. But then he says, but when I contemplate the extent of that office, embracing as it does the principal mass of domestic administration together with the foreign, I cannot be insensible of my inequality to it, and I should enter on it with gloomy forebodings from the criticisms and censures of a public just indeed in their intentions, but sometimes misinformed and misled and always too respectable to be neglected. So
I'm really glad you picked that line, that because it's a key to he knows what's coming if he takes this office. He's going to get beat up pretty bad.
Yeah, and why he felt that, I'm not quite sure. Let me say one thing about the post. So we've already said that the cabinet was an invention of President Washington. It's not a constitutional office. And at the time, the Secretary of State was really going to be the prime minister. He was going to be the most important of the president's ministers, and everything else would be lesser. That's not how it worked out in the Washington administration. The prime minister became Hamilton, and the Secretary of State, Jefferson, was sort of shoved aside. Hamilton actually invaded Jefferson's portfolio. He undermined Jefferson's status. He worked with British spies to undercut the official foreign policy of the United States. He interfered with Jefferson's attempts to operate the domestic Department of State in all sorts of different ways, and Jefferson resented it. But historically, that's neither here nor there. Historically, the office of Secretary of State didn't become the prime ministership of the United States. It's a very important office to this day, and it's in some regards still the one that's most respected of all cabinet positions. But it never became what Jefferson thought in this letter that it was going to become. But another thing that makes this so interesting, David, is Jefferson's thin skin. You see it here. I cannot but be insensible of my inequality and should enter in it with gloomy forebodings from the criticisms and censures of a public, just indeed in their intentions, but sometimes misinformed.
That's the line.
So that's what – this happens. He always says this, that the public is
– just indeed, right, but sometimes misinformed.
Yeah. That the public is going to be too hard on me, and he's basically saying, and they won't know what they're talking about. Their intentions may be good, but they really won't know what they're talking about. And who wants that sort of abuse? So this is quintessential Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
He goes on, I cannot but foresee the possibility that this may end disagreeably for me, which it did, who have no motive to public service but the public satisfaction, would certainly retire the moment that satisfaction should appear to languish, which he attempted to do. On the other hand, I feel a degree of familiarity with the duties of my present office, ambassador to France, as far at least as I am capable of understanding its duties. He's laying on the modesty pretty thick. The ground I have already passed over enables me to see the way that is before me. The change of government, too, taking place in the country where it is exercised, seems to open a possibility you know, the French Revolution means now that maybe we're going to have better diplomatic success here. Maybe you want to leave me in a post that I'm really quite familiar by now with and maybe better suited to be in. But then after that second paragraph, he says, so that as far as my fears, my hopes, or my inclination might enter into this question, I confess they would not lead me to prefer a change. Here again, notice that he doesn't say, I'd rather not be your Secretary of State. He couches it in this sort of middle, vague language. I confess they would not lead me to prefer a change. He doesn't say what that change would be. But, and here's the key Jefferson moment, it is not for an individual to choose his post. You are to marshal us as may best be for the public good, and it is only in the case of its being indifferent to you that I would avail myself of the option you have so kindly offered in your letter, which is to decline.
Well, we've spent a lot of time on this, but
it's a great letter.
It is. And I must say that the response from Washington is equally brilliant, don't you think?
Washington was every bit Jefferson's match.
Yeah.
In moments like this, so he basically says, "Look, I hear you, but you know what? I want you to be the Secretary of State.
I feel such delicacy and embarrassment in consequence of the footing on which you have placed your final determination as to make it necessary for me to recur to the first ground on which I rested the matter." It's great.
It's all lines out of Jane Austen. You sort of you have to translate each line into plain English.
He says, Washington says, "I consider the successful administration of the general government as an object of almost infinite consequence to the present and future happiness of the citizens of the United States. I consider the office of Secretary for the Department of State as very important on many accounts," and he goes on. So.
Well, the sadness of this, David, is that Jefferson accepted the post. Madison.
Well, how could he say no? How could he say no to the great man, Washington?
But the consequence is that by the time Washington died in 1799, not only were he and Jefferson no longer close, Washington no longer really respected Jefferson in the way that is clearly apparent in this exchange. And in fact, Washington regarded Jefferson as a betrayer of trust and loyalty. And he even regarded Jefferson as personally irresponsible and unscrupulous. So what began with this high regard for Jefferson as one of the great men of America, someone who was indispensable to the success of his administration, by 1799, Washington regarded Jefferson as somebody who really was of suspect integrity.
By 1799?
Washington dies in 1799.
Oh, I see. I thought, yeah.
And so in that nine-year period, Jefferson went from being essentially a flawless intellectual of Virginia and a man of the most extraordinary capacity and judgment in Washington's mind to a person that he really blotted out of his Rolodex and regarded as a kind of Machiavellian, almost treasonous character. So what a, as they say in Hamlet, what a falling off was there. Jefferson lost the respect of the greatest man of America.
He had some help, Washington did, coming to that conclusion, but we're getting ahead of ourselves.
It's sad. It's sad to me. So let me speak in a broader way for a moment, David. So Jefferson comes back from France. He's at the top of his game. He's recovered emotionally in France. He bought 86 cartons, 86 crates of stuff, couches, 59 chairs, knockoffs of great works of art, draperies, linens, tablecloths, china,
and he
wine.
Was broke.
He bought all this on credit.
I read that at this time his interest on the principal was almost half of his debt.
86 crates of stuff come home with him, and that he's just home on leave. He left the bulk of his stuff back in Paris. He gets there. He's appointed to be the Secretary of State. What Jefferson didn't realize when he came home was, this is the most important of the I hope insights we can offer our listeners. Jefferson's trajectory from the moment he had met his mentor William Small was to become a deeper and deeper intellectual figure of the Enlightenment and believer in democracy, believer a believer in the idea of a republic of farmer citizens. But while he was gone, between 1784 and 1789, the United States had had a counter-revolution. It had a conservative reaction to the perceived excesses of the revolution, and the country had become dramatically more conservative, while Jefferson had become measurably more radical. So Jefferson is moving, to use crude terms, is moving left during his time in France, not knowing that the country wasn't staying with him, and in fact that the country was moving in precisely the opposite direction. So when he gets home, he thinks that he still represents the establishment point of view, when he's actually now eccentric in the extreme and is almost immediately starts to rub people the wrong way and almost immediately perceives that that the country has changed and changed for the worse, and that he's kind of the odd man out in his own country.
Back to, we have this situation where Jefferson tries to get out of the post and Washington says, no, you must, and he agrees to it. But you had mentioned earlier that really the work of bringing Jefferson in was James Madison's. Reading John Meacham's book recently, The Art of Power, which came out, I think, about 4 years ago, and going back and rereading it, I have a whole new appreciation for that book. I really enjoyed it. But he says that Madison told him the Secretary of State was not to be in charge of all domestic affairs. He was, rather, to serve as the president's chief foreign policy advisor. Isn't that kind of what he did?
Yes, and Madison was right. And Madison actually then defines what would become the modern office of Secretary of State. That's what modern secretaries of state are, is the chief foreign policy advisor and consultant to the president of the United States. And to a certain extent, they have their own power base, but depending on the president, they answer to the larger foreign policy impulses and principles of the president. So Madison was defining, was trying to assure Jefferson that he wasn't getting himself into a kind of this prime ministership, that although he would be first among equals in dignity, the duties would be relatively less burdensome than Jefferson was anticipating.
And also, this became like this training ground for Jefferson that enabled him to do things as he did in his presidency, right?
Indeed. And if they were disillusioned with Jefferson, he was disillusioned with them. He realized pretty early on that John Adams, his old dear friend and compatriot, had taken a very conservative turn, Jefferson thought monarchical turn. Jefferson meets Hamilton for the first time in New York. That's the national capital at the time. So he had heard about him for many years. Hamilton was the aide-de-camp to George Washington for years. He was also one of the heroes of Yorktown, this dashing young man that everyone was praising, this sort of brilliant policy wonk, this upstart from the Caribbean who was a genius and who had the ear of the most important man in the world. So Jefferson was aware of Hamilton and probably thought well of him. Then he meets him and he realizes, oh, if Washington is somewhat more conservative than I would have thought, Hamilton is infinitely more conservative than I would have thought, and Hamilton is probably the reason why Washington has lost his way and, in some sense, I'm using air quotations here, betrayed the spirit of the revolution. And so Adams is sort of now become somebody that Jefferson can't quite any longer embrace. Washington, he still chooses to admire and even revere, but with increasing sense of misgiving. And Hamilton, he soon discovers, is completely off the charts. Hamilton is a monarchist. He's an aristocrat. He stands for the moneyed interest. He loves banks. He loves speculation. He may be personally corrupt. He certainly allows financial corruption to occur around him. And worst of all, well, two terrible things about Hamilton. Number one, he's a broad constructionist. We can talk about that. But he believes that the Constitution should be used with great flexibility so that government has a kind of a free hand to do what government thinks it needs to do, entirely the opposite of Jefferson's view. And worst of everything, Hamilton is incredibly persuasive that Hamilton wins the key battles. Jefferson and Hamilton suddenly find themselves at odds on almost every question, from domestic finance to interpretations of the Constitution to foreign policy. And every time that these debates occur, usually by letter, sometimes in the cabinet, they're both vying for the attention and respect of George Washington. Jefferson slowly discovers that Washington almost invariably sides with Hamilton, that Washington admires Jefferson, he listens to Jefferson, he even instinctively sort of is with Jefferson, but when push comes to shove and he has to decide, he almost inevitably decides with Hamilton against what Jefferson considers to be the principles of the Revolution, against what Jefferson considers to be the principles of an agrarian republic, and against what Jefferson believes is a true Virginian's response to the world. And so it not only upsets Jefferson, but worse than that, it's not just that he's losing battles in the cabinet. It profoundly hurts him because he believes that Washington is essentially on his side, but for some reason or other has been won over by this dark force, and that Washington is betraying the very dream of America that America exists to represent. In other words, this isn't just like, is it Mrs. Clinton or is it Trump? Is it Kennedy or is it Nixon? This is the pivotal future of the project of human liberty and happiness. And the president, for whatever reason, is making the wrong decisions because of this incredibly dynamic and brilliant man who's not really one of us. He's some upstart from the Caribbean.
Well, may I comment on a couple of things?
Yes.
You use the phrase, the dark side of
the dark side.
So we need to go there. But I think it is a couple of things. One is it's very interesting. I mean, it must have been hard on Jefferson because he sort of felt he and Washington were two of a kind.
Yeah, he wouldn't have done it. He wouldn't have accepted.
Virginia gentleman, right?
He tried to squeeze out of it. He wouldn't have done it if he'd known that Washington was going to be a Hamiltonian. He would not have allowed himself to accept the post.
We need to talk about Hamilton because it figures so greatly in this. But I read in Madison and Jefferson, the book by Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg.
Yes.
They write, Hamilton was regarded as highly knowledgeable, yet entirely tactless. The Madisonians in Congress were offended by him even before Jefferson arrived on the scene.
Yes.
Yeah. So he
annoyed people and he drove people into Jefferson's camp because of his personal arrogance and his sort of breathtaking self-confidence.
But he has a great musical. So, on that note, we are going to take just a short break. We'll be back in just a minute to discuss Hamilton and Jefferson further. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation this week about President Thomas Jefferson. We've rejoined our Jefferson 101 series, and we started at 1789 as Jefferson returned from France and was coerced into becoming the first Secretary of State by President Washington. When we took our break, we had just walked into the subject of Mr. Hamilton, and you called him the dark force or something like that?
So Jefferson is a dreamer. Jefferson is an idealist. Jefferson has studied his Virgil and his Horace and his Homer, and he believes that the ideal America would be a quiet Garden of Eden with farmers who didn't have slaves, who maybe had a hired man, a few sheep, and some chickens and some fields of grain and some vineyards, and that the farmer would work moderately hard but not oppressively hard, and then at night would read Greek and Latin texts and would sit with his amiable wife and drink a beautiful glass of Bordeaux or whatever, and that the farmer citizen would govern himself. There would be almost no government of the United States, almost no state government, almost no county government, that we would be essentially a kind of enlightened anarchy, and that we would stay out of the world's way and mind our own business and pursue happiness and write beautiful epistles to each other and so on, and that this was America. This was like man's deepest, most ancient dream of the agrarian republic, glimpses of which had been visible in Rome before Julius Caesar. So suddenly we have infinite land, the settlement in 1783, almost bizarrely, takes us all the way up to the Mississippi River, much more than we probably deserved. Jefferson will soon buy the Louisiana Territory, but even when the boundary was the Mississippi, it's essentially infinite and incredibly fertile land, watered by the greatest and most fertile river in the world, the Mississippi Valley. Jefferson thinks, this is it. This is the new Garden of Eden. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. And he actually, David, actually thought that this was America's destiny. And suddenly, along comes Hamilton saying, we're going to be a great nation. We're going to have a huge military. We're going to have central banks. We're going to have funding, national debts. We're going to have government.
Let's try very hard to be fair to present both of these gentlemen.
I am trying hard. I'm saying Jefferson was a dreamer.
Well, he's
an imaginative Virgilian dreamer.
I got an insight to Jefferson that was very clearly stated from the Burstein Eisenberg book, Madison and Jefferson. They write, Jefferson's contribution to Madisonian rhetoric was modest but meaningful. For Jefferson, no compromise was possible on the subject of concentrated cities. Now, we've talked about this a lot, how the citizen farmer. He hated cities because they spread diseases and reeked of death. He had seen the malignant effect of centralization in impoverished parts of Europe. He was sickened by the airless workhouses he visited, fearful of overpopulation, and repelled by filth. This is what urban life represented to him. The American way of life would be advanced amid rustic beauty, or else it would be lost. And I thought that was very clearly. He didn't want people gathered in the cities, and Hamilton did.
Cities were loathsome.
Is that fair?
Yes. Hamilton was an urbanite. He came from the Caribbean, but when he came to this world, to the new world of North America, he went to New York, not to a farm somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an urban creature all of his life. He had begun his life as a young boy, really, as a clerk in a merchant's house, in an import-export house in the Caribbean. So he had grown up in commerce. He'd grown up in world trade and in the early globalization of molasses and rum and so on. He comes to New York, where he goes to an urban university, to Columbia, to King's College, as it was then known. He marries into one of the most wealthy and aristocratic families in New York, the Schuyler family. He aligns himself with the great Washington. He helps to win the war by his capacity for hard work and policy and his brilliance, both on and off the field of battle. Now he's become the prime minister, effectively, for George Washington. He certainly considers himself to be the prime minister and deliberately shoulders this agrarian dreamer, Jefferson, out of the arena. Jefferson is easy pickings for Hamilton, because Jefferson is this creature out of a Jane Austen novel who wants to be polite, who wants to bow, who wants to say only the most elegant and civil thing. And Hamilton's view is, I want power, and I know how to use it, and I know what we're going to use it for.
And he was generally a very smart, intuitive, good businessman, Hamilton.
Yes, Hamilton. Right? He had a capitalist's view of the world. He had read the great economists. Jefferson never really understood economics. both in his personal life or publicly.
It's fair to say Jefferson was somewhat naive in some of this, right?
Yeah, of course. He's a dreamer, and he's a wonderful dreamer, and we're so fortunate that at the heart of the American idea was this dreamer. But we also need men with their feet firmly on the ground and women, and Hamilton was the polar opposite of Jefferson, equally important and ultimately more persuasive today. There's no question that we're essentially a Hamiltonian country, but be that as it may, Jefferson was not prepared for this, and he wouldn't have taken the job if Washington had said, by the way, the guy that is going to be one of the other two or three cabinet ministers is unbelievably ambitious. He's urban. He likes war. He likes a strong central economy. He wants banks. And I'm disposed to agree with him.
When you mentioned earlier some of your disagreements with
Jefferson's disagreements.
Your disagreements with Hamilton, you used a phrase. I want to go to you said he used British spies.
He did.
There's in history, we're doomed to go to the only record that exists. Well, George Beckwith.
British secret agent in Canada.
Unofficial British minister. He made notes of a meeting that he had with Mr. Hamilton. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, go ahead.
I was hoping you would. I mean, it's revelatory. Is that the great way to put it?
Yes, it is.
Because he talks about Madison. It says he's very little acquainted with the world, Hamilton tells.
Of Madison.
Yeah, don't worry. He tells Beckwith, don't worry about him. He's very little acquainted with the world. And he's like as if he's trying to sort of soften this Englishman up, tell him what he wants to hear.
Well, so let me make the best case we can for Hamilton.
Okay, good.
Hamilton believed that any rational analysis showed that our prime trading partnership was with England, that maybe we were politically independent from Britain, but we were economically very interrelated with Britain and dependent upon British Navy and the British economic system. Therefore, it was in our interest to accommodate British policy even when it was perceived to be unfair to us because the alternative was worse, that in the long run our prosperity would deepen and broaden because of the British connection, that time was on our side, that Britain may be mistreating us now, partly because they're still bitter about the revolution, but over time we would become economically indispensable and we would be a bigger economy than Britain's, and so we should put up with some frustrations and annoyances in the short term because this was good for us in the long term. And that Jefferson, who maybe spent a little too much time in France, who maybe was a little too intellectual, maybe a little too little grounded in the real world, that Jefferson should not be our prime foreign policy spokesman because Jefferson had some sort of a resentment towards Britain that was really out of keeping with good sense and policy. And so he, Hamilton, would work quietly behind the scenes with this Beckwith and with some others to assure them of two things. First of all, that Jefferson didn't necessarily speak for this administration. And even if Jefferson did speak for this administration, it would be smarter for the United States and Britain to have a cozier accommodation, and he, Hamilton, was willing to fight for British interests with his friendship of Washington.
He showed the United States cards to Beckwith.
Right, undermining, deliberately undermining the foreign policy of the United States.
And Washington, according to the notes, he said that America thinks in English, they have a similarity of prejudices and predilections, and took liberties that Washington would not have approved of, and sort of said, no, we're not going to do anything with France. We need a commercial treaty with you guys, isn't that Jefferson's area?
Yes.
So that's
an example. Jefferson was, in fact, speaking for the administration, even when he disagreed with it. He tried
beautifully. Hamilton did not.
Hamilton's view was, I'm smarter than Jefferson, certainly. And by the way, I'm also smarter than Washington, and we're just going to do what we need to do. And I think I can turn this to our interest and Britain's interest. Hamilton, I'm sure, knew that he was technically betraying Washington's trust and that he was technically committing an act of treason against the official foreign policy of the United States, but he saw it as worth it.
And he told Beckwith, you know, this is a time when treaties were being, over territory were being developed. Territory was kind of a fluid thing. And he told Beckwith that he thought that the United States was sufficiently large, and if we had more territory, it would just weaken our government.
Right. So one of the big sore issues between the United States and Britain at this point is the forts of the West.
Right.
The Great Lakes forts, the fur trade. So the fur trade is really the first global trade, and it's immensely important. And the United States wants in. Britain has a monopoly of the interior fur trade with the Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company. And so, according to the Treaty of 1783, the British are to relinquish their presence in those Great Lakes forts. They do not. Their view is there's no Yankee around, so we're going to continue. It's lucrative, and who cares about the treaty? And secondly, the United States is too weak to really challenge us in this area, so we're just going to continue along these lines until such time as we have no choice but to withdraw. And Hamilton is saying, that's fine by me. It works perfectly well.
We have Jefferson stating in letters to Madison that there was a preference, that we should show a preference for our wartime ally, France. And Hamilton was telling a high-level British guy just the complete opposite. So
it's not just our wartime ally. It's we have a treaty of amity with France, 1778. We're required to consult them on some questions of international policy, and we're required to support them if they're attacked in the West Indies, in the Caribbean. And we also owe them a great deal of money, and we also remember that Franklin had gotten us the French alliance, and the French alliance had been essential to the American independence movement. Yorktown could not have happened without the French fleet, and so on. And so Jefferson's view is not only do we owe a moral debt to the French, but we actually have a legal binding treaty with the French. And just because it might be more economically profitable for us to side with the British, now the World War was coming because of the Napoleonic era, we have to be honorable to the treaties of the United States, and we must never forget that our freedom depends in large part upon the French loans that we were given, thanks to Franklin, and upon the fighting of the French forces, especially the French Navy. And so Jefferson's view is, this is not a one nation or another nation choice, where do we get the best deal? This is the sacred honor of American independence and freedom and the honor of our new constitutional republic. And why is Hamilton undermining sacred treaties for mere economic gain?
Well, getting away from the argument as to who is right and who is wrong, the problem I see with this is that President Washington's administration was speaking with multiple voices. Do you think he had any idea, or was there any master plan? Was Hamilton playing the field to get the best deals, or what?
I think that it began to dawn on President Washington that his two prime secretaries were at each other's throats, that they had diametrically opposed ideas of what this country should be and where its principles should lie, and that they were working hard to undermine each other, Hamilton more directly, Jefferson more indirectly. I think this really hurt him because I think Washington felt a couple of things, David. First of all, he rightly felt, I'm Washington. I'm the father of my country. I'm the indispensable man. I was unanimously selected, begged to be the president of the United States. I tried to retire. First, they forced me to go to the Constitutional Convention, which I didn't want to do. Then they forced me to be the first president, which I didn't want to do. I have earned the fundamental respect of the entire population of the United States. Even George III of England said I was the greatest man in history for not becoming a tyrant after the war. I have a right for these people who are way down the mountain of greatness from me to be loyal. And why are they at each other's throats? My character, my historic achievement alone should guarantee their loyalty. So I think this really bothered him. And secondly, I think he thought, no matter what else is the case, Our republic cannot survive if we're tearing each other's vitals, a term that he used, within the first cabinet. There should be solidarity. We should be able to come to some sort of a reasonable consensus amongst gentlemen about how to proceed in the world. And if these two great men, he thought they were both great in different ways, are operating to undercut each other, they're not just damaging each other, they're damaging the prospects of this fragile little republic that we're trying to grow here in the new world. And so Washington grew very impatient with this, and he starts by trying to play down their differences, and then he tries harder at that, and then he writes to each one saying, I think you should try harder to understand the other person, and he's a good person, and I think some of your views of him are a bit alarmist.
So Washington wanted harmony too.
And then when that didn't work, then he writes to them more plaintively and says, you two need to work it out and get along. I count on this. And then they still do it. And what he really wants to do is say, you're both out of here. But he can't. And of course, here's the part that's painful to a Jeffersonian, David. When it comes right down to it, if Washington had to choose which of his two surrogate sons to keep and which to banish, it's Hamilton that he would keep and it's Jefferson that he would have to get rid of.
Always comes down to the money, doesn't it? You can hear the music. We're not going to finish this conversation this
week. It's sad because Jefferson was this genius, this brilliant philosopher, farmer, this ideological visionary of what an agrarian republic should be. And in a sense, Jefferson represented the dream of human happiness better than Hamilton, but Hamilton said, you know what, it's really about money and power, and I can bring that, and Jefferson can't.
Well, next week, let's pick this up with the assumption, shall we?
So now we haven't gotten to their big foreign policy debates over the Nootka Sound issue and the French Revolution, and we haven't talked much about the assumption bills of how to bring the United States finances onto a kind of firm and stable footing. Next week. So we'll see you all then for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.